This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new. What's new?
Chemistry.
Botany.
Evolution.
Information technology.
Cosmology.
Mathematics. Ecology.
Oceanography.
Planetary science.
Medicine.
Biotechnology.
Astronomy.
Welcome to the March 3rd edition of SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on SciPod, Ship of Secrets, a new robot explores the life of ancient Greece from the bottom of the sea. Red Rain, the bizarre story of the day the aliens landed in Kerala, India. And from racing horses to racing particles to racing couples, we'll give you the inside track on this week's science news. But first, for archaeologists, an ancient shipwreck isn't the place to find treasure. It is a treasure. Each sunken ship is like a snapshot that offers a glimpse into the economic and cultural life of an entire people. The problem is, exploring that snapshot can take years. But now, a new piece of technology is changing all that. An underwater robot nicknamed Seabed can do the job in hours, and the process could revolutionize our understanding of ancient civilizations. Brendan Foley is an archaeologist and historian of science and technology at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He recently used Seabed to explore a shipwreck in the Mediterranean Sea, and this week he told New Scientist Ivan Semenek all about it.
Dr. Foley, can you tell us about this wreck? What kind of ship is it, and where was it found?
The wreck was found about a mile off the Greek Aegean island of Chios, which may be familiar to some people as the birthplace of the epic poet Homer. The wreck's about 200 feet, about 70 meters deep off the island, and it's a merchant ship that dates back to the classical period. We're pretty excited about it because the classical period is not only the birth of democracy, but it's also the period when some of the most famous Greek philosophers and mathematicians lived. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle all lived right around the same time that this ship sank.
Wow, so it sounds like the kind of wreck that could potentially reveal a lot of information about ancient Greece. How do you go about extracting that information with a robot as your tool?
The robot collects data for us, and that's very useful because up until this point, the only way we could access shipwrecks was by scuba diving. And that necessarily limited us to very shallow water, 50 meters, about 150 feet or less. So now with this robotic technology, we can access 99% of the seafloor, all the way down to depths of 6,000 meters, maybe even more. The robot collects all kinds of data for us. On the Chios project, it was collecting high-resolution digital photographic images, also bathymetric maps that were collected with a sonar, and chemical data, environmental data, with different kinds of sensors that sniff for chemicals. So the goal here is to look at all this data and try to figure out what the ship was carrying, where we think it came from, make some guesses about where it was going, and then relate all that to the history and the archaeology of the period that we know from other projects.
And I can see how useful it would be to have a robot that can go much deeper than human divers can go. Of course, on the other hand, human divers can be very careful and thoughtful when they're working with such a fragile piece of history. Can you explain the design of the robot, how it allows you to compensate for that?
The robot is particularly useful because it never touches the wreck, and we can program it to go very, very slowly and move very precisely. So on this project, we programmed the robot to stay about 2.5 meters, about 8 feet, 9 feet, above the shipwreck and move at a speed of about 20 centimeters per second, which is less than half a knot. So as the vehicle moves slowly over this wreck in these very precise track lines, it was taking these images for us, it was making these bathymetric maps, and really doing in a matter of hours what would take divers something on the order of one or two or maybe even more complete field seasons.
And now, how does a scientist reap those rewards? What kind of information are you getting from this shipwreck in particular, and what is it telling you that you wouldn't have been able to know sooner?
Well, with this wreck, without the robot, simply it would have been out of reach. We never would have seen this wreck without robotic technology. So right away, any information that we derive from the wreck is new information, important information. On this particular wreck, what the robot is showing us through the photographic images and the photo mosaics that we eventually make from that data is the entire assemblage of cargo, at least all that's still left. Of course, all the organic material, all the wood and things like that get consumed. They get eaten up by critters on the shipwreck in the water within the first 100 or 200 years. So what we're left with is the inorganic material, the cargo remains. In this case, it's hundreds and hundreds of wine amphoras. Amphoras are the ceramic storage containers that were sort of the 55-gallon drum, or maybe the milk jug of antiquity.
Now, you talked about the era in which this ship was built and when it sank as kind of the flowering of classical Greece. What are these wine bottles likely to tell us about that time?
Well, it tells us a little bit, at least, of the trade that was actually going on in the classical period, sort of the end of the classical period. We know Chios was one of the strongest and longest-serving allies of Athens during the First Athenian League in the middle of the classical period, and also the Second Athenian League toward the end of the classical period. Of course, Athens and Sparta are at war almost continually for about 200 years. So Chios is providing foodstuffs, it's providing wine, it's providing men and ships to its staunch ally Athens, until right about the period of this shipwreck, the middle of the 4th century BC, a war breaks out called the Social War, and the Athenian League begins to disintegrate. And it's called the Social War because Athens goes to war with her former allies, including Chios. So a question we have from this wreck is, what happens to the pattern of trade? What happens to the entire economy of the Aegean world after these strong allies break their partnership? Is this ship still going to Athens with its cargo of wine, or was it going to one of the new colonies that the Greeks had established in the Black Sea? So that's an open question, but at least now we've got the data to examine to begin to pose these questions.
Now, I guess the power of this method of exploration isn't just that you can look at one ship much more quickly and get the information that it has to offer you, but I guess this also means that you could then go to other shipwrecks with equal speed and perhaps build up a larger picture that would have otherwise taken perhaps decades to do.
That's exactly right. That's the whole promise of this technology. We spent just 2 days on this first classical wreck at Chios. We finished way before we thought we would, and then we were left saying, what should we do with the rest of our cruise time? So we ended up looking at two more shipwrecks in the space of a week, one dating to the Roman period, the early Roman period. So the analogy we use is each shipwreck is sort of like a page from a book, and every shipwreck that we look at adds another page, another chapter, really, to that story that we're trying to tell about the past. The more pages we have, the more complete our reconstruction of that story becomes.
Well, I can see how powerful it is now to have a robot as part of your expedition team, but I'm wondering how the expedition ends in that case. I mean, do you celebrate with your robot? What happens when your season is over?
When the season's over, we go back and make changes to the robot. The beautiful thing about being here at the Oceanographic Institution and surrounded by these brilliant engineers is that they're never satisfied with the job they've done. So we celebrated while we were on the ship at Chios with the success that we felt we had surveying the shipwreck. But immediately, within hours, the team started scratching their heads and saying, well, I think we could get better pictures. Or what if we collected different kinds of chemical data? Or how about a new kind of sensor that can look down into the sediments so we can get more information rather than just what's on the surface? So the celebration really takes the form of new work to do.
Well, that's great, Dr. Foley. Thanks very much for telling us about it. It's a very exciting development in a very interesting field.
Well, my pleasure speaking with you.
Dr. Brendan Foley spoke to us from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. And if you'd like to dive further into his tale of underwater discovery, you can find lots more in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, here is Jeff Davis and Donna Page with a look at this week's science news.
The use of stem cells in human medicine is a controversial subject these days, but for racehorses, stem cells are quickly becoming real winners. Researchers at the UK's Royal Veterinary College have been treating racehorses with leg injuries by injecting stem cells into their damaged limbs. The stem cells help heal the damage by generating new tissue that fills in gaps and tears created during the injury. The stem cells come from the horse's own bone marrow and are then multiplied in the lab. The researchers report that 80% of horses treated this way have become well enough to return to the racetrack. That's compared with just 30% of horses treated with conventional methods. The success offers hope that in the future, human stem cell therapies could help people suffering from shoulder damage or acute injuries to the Achilles tendon.
Scientists have a new explanation for dark energy, the mysterious stuff that seems to be causing the expansion of the universe to speed up. Currently, the leading candidate for dark energy is Albert Einstein's cosmological constant, which relies on the idea that the vacuum of space is bubbling with enough energy to counteract the force of gravity and cause space to expand at an ever-increasing rate. Now, a team of Italian physicists say that neutrinos may offer a simpler explanation. Neutrinos are ghostly subatomic particles that rarely interact with other forms of matter. Calculations show they must have been produced in huge numbers during the Big Bang. Those Big Bang neutrinos are still around today, and the team says the way they interact with space itself could provide the energy needed to drive the acceleration of the universe. In the future, this idea will be put to the test by space telescopes that can measure how the effect of dark energy on the cosmos is changing with time.
Scientists are reassessing their understanding of how mammals evolved thanks to a spectacular new discovery in China. The fossil is a 164-million-year-old mammal that looked and probably behaved somewhat like a modern beaver. Sediments settling at the bottom of an ancient lake flattened the fossil and preserved important details, including impressions of hair and a flat, scaly tail. The creature measured about half a meter long, and its teeth were adapted to eating fish. The fossil reveals that mammals were both larger and more diverse during the Jurassic period than was once thought, and that their warm-blooded metabolism originated very early.
And finally, however severely men and women may criticize each other's driving, a new study shows that drivers of both sexes are more like their partners than they may think. The study was conducted by traffic psychologists at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Researchers asked over 400 couples to rate their own driving skills, as well as those of their partners. The results show that even though men tended to rate themselves as more aggressive behind the wheel than women, the female partners of the most aggressive male drivers were themselves more reckless and aggressive than other female drivers. The study did not reveal whether the couples gradually developed their similar driving styles or whether aggressive drivers of the opposite sex are simply more likely to run into each other.
SciPod, giving you audio updates in science and technology news as gathered and written by the staff of New Scientist magazine.
In July of 2001, the rain in Kerala, India turned red. Now that's strange enough, but then two scientists from Mahatma Gandhi University decided to investigate. The conclusion they reached has generated some excitement and a lot of controversy, because if they're right, the source of the red rain is biological, and it may not have come from this planet. Those scientists are now about to publish their findings in the Journal of Astrophysics and Space Science. It's one of the strangest stories New Scientist has come across in years, and science journalist Hazel Muir has been covering the whole thing. We reached her in London.
Hazel, let's start at the beginning. Tell me about the red rain of Kerala.
Well, this story goes back to the year 2001, when a very strange thing happened in southern India. For about 2 months, red-coloured rain fell right across Kerala, which is on the southern tip of India. And there were plenty of eyewitness reports of it. You know, sometimes people said that the rain had a bit of a red tint, and at other times the colour of the rain was so strong that people compared it to blood. So basically everyone was very puzzled by this, and so two physicists in Kerala, Godfrey Lewis and his colleague Santosh Kumar, decided that they would like to study some of it in the lab. So they gathered some samples of the red rain and looked at it under the microscope. And he did come to this very strange conclusion that these are biological cells and that they are not terrestrial ones, but they may have actually travelled to Earth on a comet.
Well, okay, now this is obviously, there's a lot of interesting details here, and I think we just should back up and first say, how was it that they actually gathered these samples? I mean, were they able to be on the scene when the red rain was falling, or how soon after were they there?
They there was one Earth Sciences Institute in the region that actually did gather red rain samples at the time. They sampled the rain from places more than 100 kilometres apart, and they kept it in their lab, and that was the source of the samples that Godfrey Lewis studied.
Now, the idea that rain could be the color of blood, in some cases, this kind of vivid tint, is there any kind of meteorological explanation? I mean, is this a phenomenon that has happened anywhere before?
Well, certainly there have been reports of red rain before, but they usually have been fairly easy to explain. In southern England in 1968, for example, some red rain coated parts of England, and it turned out that, surprisingly, this was sort of red grit that had blown all the way from the Sahara Desert. So that's the kind of explanation that you would normally think of. However, it doesn't seem to work in this case.
So then what did they find when they took a closer look at the sample of red rain?
Well, under the microscope, the cells certainly do look biological. They look rounded and blobby. They don't look like the typical sort of jagged shape of grit. They certainly look biological, and when they performed lab tests on them, they found that they did not actually contain DNA.
So that's interesting. They seem biological, or they look biological, so they sort of have the shape of cells, it sounds like, but they don't have DNA, so how do we know if these things are alive, I guess?
Well, Lewis claims in earlier work to have cultured these cells, although that's not what he's claiming in the current paper. But basically, many scientists agree that we don't really know whether these things are living or not until people in other labs are given the chance to try and culture them, to see perhaps if they respire or if they germinate, just to do a battery of biological tests on them.
So this is quite interesting. If they are, in fact, some kind of biological material, then where do they come from?
Well, that's the big mystery, because first of all, I mean, people might suggest that they were fungal spores that might have accumulated in the atmosphere, or they might be some kind of pollen, or they might be algae, something perfectly natural that somehow got swept up into the rain clouds and then fell down as rain. However, you would expect pollen or algae, for instance, to contain DNA, so that's a bit surprising. Another thing that some scientists have suggested after looking at the micrographs of the red particles is that they actually look amazingly like red blood cells, mammalian red blood cells. Now, mammalian red blood cells do not normally contain DNA, so that would fit with the lack of DNA in the cells. However, it's really very difficult to explain how you might get so much mammalian blood into the rain clouds. That's quite astonishing.
Now, of course, that's strange enough, but then I guess the other question is how do you tie this to something that could be extraterrestrial? What would be the mechanism of delivery?
Well, what Godfrey Lewis points out is that on the day that the first red rain fell, on that morning, people heard a very loud sonic boom right in the region where the first red rain fell. Now, that suggests that possibly a meteor exploded in the atmosphere. So Godfrey Lewis's idea is that a comet came in from space, it travelled from north to south over Kerala, and it was shedding lots of alien microbes into space, and then finally it exploded over southern Kerala, and that's where the first red rain began. And he thinks that basically fragments of the comet and the microbes that it carried settled down into the rain clouds over the following couple of months and gradually fell as rain. So he says that's the only possible explanation that he can think of.
Well, it seems like an extraordinary claim, but of course we do have the documentation of this red rain and a sample and these unusual micrographs. I know you've been covering astronomy and space science for a long time, Hazel. What was your approach to handling a story like this?
Well, it's very difficult. I kind of felt it was necessary to stand back from it a little. It's certainly an extraordinary conclusion to come to. Very, very elaborate and perhaps very overcomplicated. So my approach to it was really just to canvass as many opinions as possible. Now, I didn't really find anyone willing to speculate like Lewis did that these are actually alien microbes. Most people I talked to said you'd need a hell of a lot more evidence before you could come to such a drastic conclusion as that. But everyone who I talked to did seem very intrigued by it because It is actually very hard to explain this. It definitely happened. There's plenty of proof of it. And I think everyone's just really keen to see what the proper explanation actually is.
And as we said earlier, the researchers are going to now be publishing this work. So where do you think this will lead?
Well, I think that they're hoping to publish their earlier work on culturing these cells as well after this paper. And I know that Godfrey Lewis has sent some samples of the red rain to a laboratory in Sheffield here in the UK. And they are now starting tests on the red particles to see whether they contain DNA, to see if they divide or germinate. So hopefully with more labs doing more biochemical tests, we'll get to the bottom of this pretty soon.
Well, thanks, Hazel, for telling us about it. I think you've given our listeners a very unusual story to chew on.
Thank you very much.
Hazel Muir writes about astronomy and space science for New Scientist. Her investigation into the red rains of Kerala is this week's cover story.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today and you'll save 40% off our annual price and get unlimited free access to the entire content of newscientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit www.newscientist.com/2504. That's newscientist.com/2504 for the week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the March 4th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also, in this week's issue, say goodbye to cheap chicken. With avian flu turning up on a poultry farm in France, the entire European industry stands poised on the edge of disaster. Rest in peace. If nuclear power is making a comeback, so is the problem of radioactive waste. Can a Scandinavian effort lead the way to a nuclear tomorrow? And buildings and brains, exploring the connection between neuroscience and architecture. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.